Hey guys, Ferret's Den podcast. I know there's been a little bit of time between recordings, but we thought we'd get another podcast out to you for the holiday season. I know a few people are going on a couple of long drives made for Christmas lunch, and so this might be something you can tune into. I'm here with Josh Kalak-Kavanagh, the head of data and performance here at Caramar Racing.
G'day guys. Good to be back on another podcast and give you something to digest over the Christmas and New Year period. David Rath is on this week's episode, who is the Coaching, Innovation and Game Strategy Manager at the Essendon Football Club. David has an extensive background, being with the Hawthorn Football Club during their premiership era back in the 2010s as the head of coaching and innovation back then, as well as spending 3 years at the St Kilda Footy Club as the head of football. David also started his time 20 years ago now at the AIS, working with the rowing and swimming teams amongst many other codes. He's well versed in the biomechanics and strategy space. So we really hope you guys enjoy the episode.
Enjoy.
David, thanks for coming on this episode of the podcast. Tell us a little bit about your current role and also a little bit about your past.
Sure, yeah. My current role's in the sort of coaching innovation game strategy space with the Bombers. Previously, I worked in sports science, biomechanics, technique analysis, that sort of space at the Australian Institute of Sport in the sort of period either side of the Sydney Olympics. And after that, moved into the AFL space, firstly with Hawthorn. I was there for 13 years, from 2005 to 2018. Went to the AFL for a short period in the sort of game analysis and rule change and coaching education space, before having a stint with the Saints, the Wallabies, as you mentioned, and now with Essendon.
Oh, that's quite a. I just feel like the time that you've worked and there would have been a lot of change over that sort of period. It'll be really interesting to sort of dig into that. I'm not sure how much you know about Caramar Racing and the work that we're doing in the sort of sports science area, but we've sort of been in that pivotal time where there's been a lot of change and introduction of using technologies and changing the way we train our horses. So I think that would be quite interesting to get from your perspective.
Well, that period, around the 2000s was a pivotal change in particularly in biomechanics with the advent of a lot of digital technologies, which made motion capture in particular a lot easier. When you're looking at how people move, you want to quantify it. And when I started at the AIS, we were doing that with the old cine film, where we'd actually film with the cine photography, cine film that basically they use for making motion pictures. We'd have to get that developed, and then we'd sit down and manually digitize. So you'd have to go through and watch each frame of vision, and manually sort of mark with a cursor, where the joint landmarks were. And then you'd go through and process it. And that was a really laborious process. So from, the starting point of getting your film, it could be months later before you'd have any data. By the time I finished at the AIS, the technologies had changed dramatically. And we had, marker-based motion capture, which meant you could turn around the data, within a day. And now it's even quicker. There's markerless systems that you can give you instantaneous data. So yeah, there's been a massive change in the way you go about things because of technology and biomechanics for sure.
Yeah, it's really interesting about that work you've seen along the journey, and no doubt you saw it a long, long time ago. From the biomechanic point of view, we're trying to look at a little bit in terms of our horses. We use some software that uses motion analysis to objectively quantify trot ups. So we're basically trying to monitor gait and any changes in gait from a visual point standpoint. Was there anything about your work back at the AIS to look at sort of monitoring for injury risk prevention? Was it a performance related measures you were looking at? Or sort of talk us through what you're actually monitoring there from a biomechanic point of view.
Yeah, sure. Well, ironically, one of the first biomechanical studies ever performed was by a guy called Muybridge, who's considered one of the fathers of biomechanics, and that was on equine gait. So, trying to quantify when a horse galloped, I think it was galloping, whether it had all four hoofs off the ground or not. And so there's some great old footage of that being done. And they found, yes, that was the case, that all four hoofs were off the ground. But, yeah, ironically, the early biomechanics was done on horses. And then they started using this technology and applying it to other forms of movement. So there's some really cool old, you know, stuff on file that you can find of horse gait. But yeah, with the humans, it was both. It was for technique analysis and for injury prevention. Did a lot of work in close conjunction with the physiotherapists at the AIS in those days, where we used a lot of the Vicon technology, which is the marker system I referred to before. So you basically put little retroreflective spheres on and attach them by tape, and you track the body segments that way. So that was largely injury prevention, but then with some of the other coaching applications, it was more around technique. So definitely both. But there's been a real transition, I think, in how we think about, human movement and optimizing technique. And I think when I started off in this area, there was definitely the feeling or the idea that we were trying to search for an optimal technique, and that if we could identify that, then we could coach everyone to do that technique. And that's changed dramatically, and we now realize that there are multiple ways of doing things, and there's been quite a few studies which have looked at how we move in key Olympic sports and found, you know, champions do things differently. They don't all move the same. So we're not necessarily trying to identify one optimal technique for everyone anymore. We're trying to look at the common factors, but also the variability and the functional variability, so that variability is not such a bad thing in human movement. We don't want to try and necessarily do the same thing exactly the same, but a feature of expertise is being able to modify that variability functionally, so to actually change your technique to the demands. So, yeah, I mean, maybe in a horse application, that may mean that a horse subtly changes the way it gallops on different surfaces, to deal with that. So that'd be the application in how biomechanics has changed over the past 15 or 20 years in how we've looked at things, I think, in your sphere, perhaps.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've picked up a few points there, but in everything that we're doing with horses, we've sort of found a similar pattern of way of looking at horses, just even with their heart rate, their locomotion, recovery, sort of every element. There's no real one set profile that says this horse is going to be a champion and this horse is not, or this horse is going to be a sprinter and this horse is going to be a stayer. It's sort of trying to find a baseline for a horse and then monitor that and then, you know, train that horse individually and try and improve them for the type of horse they are.
Yeah.
So I think I'm probably always trying to relate back to horses based on what you're discussing there. But I picked up when you said that you work closely with a physio. So if you are monitoring an athlete, are you working with the physio then to do exercises to change the way they move or strengthen if they have a weakness? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of that would be screening. So you're getting baseline measurements, trying to quantify how an athlete moves when they're healthy, and then you can look at deviations from that. There was work done with, putting in orthotics and seeing how that altered people's movements, definitely pre and post injury, looking at changes and changes in variability as well, because variability can be a signal of healthy gait, or it can be, if there's a lack of variability or the ability to adapt, then that can be a signal for someone who's perhaps at risk.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because so if you were working with a horse and you noticed that they had something technically wrong with their gait and you wanted to improve it, I'm just thinking if you were working with an athlete that couldn't communicate with you, I think that's where our difficulty lies with using biomechanics, because we can't explain to a horse that we need them to strengthen this area or... But, yeah, how would you sort of, take on a task like that?
Yeah, well, this is a fascinating area, and there's been, again, a lot of change in this space with humans, and there's almost a suggestion that technology has given us too much information in some senses, and that we can overcoach, and that there is still a fair bit of coaching which is around trying to identify this perfect technique and trying to get everyone to kick this, in footy it's trying to get everyone to kick the same. you know, and that's not necessarily the right way to go about it. So the other approach is to, instead of telling someone how to move, is to use constraints to shape how they move. So, for example, you know, if we're working on someone's balance when they're moving, we'll make their balance, we challenge their balance. So we might get them, you know, walking on a beam or something like that, rather than necessarily saying, we want you to be better balanced when you walk. You know, if we're working on someone, an idea is, say, someone's having a problem with their stance leg with a kicking, and we want them to be a little bit more aware of their balance. We can get them to wear a sock on a basketball court rather than their boots, where they're more challenged, and that'll change the way they move. So, shaping the environment and shaping the task with different constraints is a really different way of doing it. And you can elicit different movement from changing the demands of the task as opposed to telling them what to do. You know, so with your stuff, it might be that changing surfaces, you know, obviously changing heights of obstacles if they're jumping horses and things like that, could be ways to go about it. You might even, you know, have potentially different, you know, hoof plates. I'm not probably using the right technical terms there, but you could be playing around with stuff like that that could change the dynamics of the way they move. Without telling them, or you can't tell them, obviously, with a horse. But we do that sort of thing with humans as well. So adapting the balls, adapting the equipment, using, you know, in striking sports, it's using different weighted instruments. In tennis, you can do it by changing the speed of the balls. All that sort of stuff is a different way to go about it, which is really productive.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And I think we just touched on about there about this overload of information. And one that I just had noted down for you was how a couple of years ago we were at a conference and someone was talking about, you know, how athlete surveying is the new rage, and, you know, athlete surveying data is coming through constantly. And I've talked to a lot of people who sometimes say, you know, they can't really use that much. And I was just interested to get your take on it, because it was interesting from our perspective that we're not actually able to communicate with our athletes that much. I was just wondering, when you're trying to strengthen up these bits, you know, these specific skills and areas of these athletes, how much value you can put into those surveys. And we can obviously ask sort of the jockeys for feedback, who are probably the closest to the athlete at the time. But yeah, just interesting to hear how you use that sort of athlete survey data.
Yeah, well, definitely our high performance and conditioning guys use, you know, the RPE, which is the rate of perceived exertion. We get that sort of feedback, you know, following drills and at the end of sessions and stuff like that, which is useful data, but not on its own. You know, we'll combine that data with, you know, a whole range of different scores around muscle soreness and sleep, and, you know, just trying to flag stuff that might pop up. It's useful. It doesn't always tell a story. Sometimes, you know, your eye tells you more, and that, you know, you actually need to see them in the performance environment. I visited Paris Saint-Germain, which were, you know, obviously a high-level soccer team in France some years ago, and they did a lot of monitoring, but they found the most useful thing was to actually to check the readiness of their players. What they'd do is they'd put them into a small-sided game at the start of training and get live data on how they were responding in that, rather than actually relying on surveys. They'd put them in the performance environment and get a sample and then respond to that at the start of training. So if the players were flagging in that game, they'd have data that they could actually use to modify their training. So, yeah. It's different than asking players, but it's another way of going about it. And I think that's a really useful approach.
Yeah, I actually had a brief conversation with Cody Waitman from the Bulldogs.
Yep.
And yep. He was saying that all their players, they do an adductor test, and then that would tell them if they were at risk of injury, or would change their training regime for that day if they were fatigued or based on that test. Is that something that you've done at Essendon? Or
Our physios and our rehab team do that at Essendon. I'm not involved explicitly in that. I do get exposed to that data, and we have regular high performance meetings where we're, you know, talking around player readiness and how players are tracking, and that's one of the points of conversation always. We, you know, there's regular screening that's done, which is updated and informative for sure.
So how does it all work at Essendon or other places that you've worked with regard to what you do in the biomechanics and then your sports science and the players and the coaching team and how decisions are made around players or how that's all sort of communicated? Or
yeah, so my role's probably morphed a long way from being a, you know, what you call a biomechanics role since I've started in footy. I've moved into different areas, and one of those is game strategy. One of those is the more skill acquisition space. So I don't strictly work in the biomechanics space anymore, but I still have obviously that baseline knowledge and can apply those ideas and have input into decision making using a biomechanical lens. But it's a collaborative process. So, you know, we'll have regular meetings where we sit down with our doctors, our physios, our rehab staff and our conditioning staff. And there's a coaching presence in that meeting as well, where we'll, you know, basically go through the whole list of our players and you know, status update and red flag, workout plans moving forward, to modify loads as necessary for the upcoming week. So, yeah, that's an ongoing discussion with all stakeholders. And it's always a balance because we're trying, especially this time of the year, we're trying to get, you know, conditioning load into the men football load, but it's a fine balance and you don't always get it right. And sometimes, you know, you get a few that flip over the edge, and it's a little bit like the canary in the coal mine that, you know, you want to be close to that edge, but you don't want to be pushing over it consistently. And you will get a few little red flags, and monitoring those closely is really important, but you're not going to get through without, without getting those niggles. You're always going to have a few that crop up, but it's how you modify and monitor. And yeah, it's a very collaborative process.
Yeah, that's really speaks volumes, and it's exactly the same as what we do with horses here, and trying to, you know, combine as many data points and as much feedback as we can, and you know, using everything together to try and work out exactly where they are on that load and the how they're handling the work. And so it's quite cool to see how, you know, quite a different sport, but how it sort of all aligns in the same way as well.
Yeah, we track their training loads really closely. We have a number of metrics that we use in terms of their, you know, the different speed bands that they move in, and their accelerations. They're probably the key metrics that our high performance staff look at in terms of profiling each session, and we work closely. So the planning of training is a really collaborative process as well, done with, you know, our coach from a tactical perspective will look at what we're trying to get out of a week, and then we'll sit down with our high performance staff together and we'll say, well, these are the constraints, this is the amount of load we want to get into them, you know, we want this much low level load, this much of the higher speed stuff, watch later on this week, because there's a couple who are coming off a camp, we're all coming off a camp, we'd recently been on camp to Buller, so you know that will impact things. It's very collaborative, and it combines the tactical and the physiological and the psychological.
I guess it's interesting to talk about that, and we're monitoring that going forward as well, and we database it obviously, and you probably would be collating that from wherever you've worked in the past as well. But how much sort of applied metrics that you apply these days from day to day, that have you learnt from sort of the research you've done in the past? And obviously I touched base about sort of looked at your, you know, research gate. You've been involved in a lot of research publications, which we'll pop in the link to the podcast for this episode, which is, there's some really interesting stuff in there. But we're trying to get involved more and more with this space, since we've got such large data sets for equine based research institutions to go off. Sort of how much have you learned in the past from sort of research collaborations with universities and the like?
Yeah, look, definitely the research stuff's informative. It's different working with, particularly from a skill perspective, very, very different working with athletes from a coaching perspective as working from a scientific perspective, because when we're running a scientific study, we're trying to look for, differences between experts and novices, or, you know, optimizing individual technique, that sort of thing. Whereas with individual athletes, you know, with I suppose the difference is with research studies, we're using that really high burden of proof. You know, you're looking for that P equals 0.05, that very small margin, and the burden of proof is quite high from a statistical significance point of view, whereas with coaching, you just want a difference. You don't necessarily need that, you know, that really clinical data-driven decision making that would be generalized across populations. You're just looking at changes with individual athletes. So it's a really different focus from a coaching lens than it is from a research lens. I think that's one thing that's distinctly different about the two realms I've worked in. With one, yes, you're looking at big data sets and you're looking for trends. And so you've got a lot of subjects, and that can cloud differences, whereas it's almost N equals one. Every athlete is one subject, and you've got to individualize, which gives you more freedom in some ways. So big differences in that regard.
We're actually doing a bit of research ourselves, and I understand what you're saying there with, you know, sort of trying to look for something. And obviously there's not as much research in the equine world, not in an applied sort of setting or within an actual race or stable. You know, when you look at the research that's been done in horses or race horses, it's always sort of, you know, five or six horses and two drop out for whatever reason. So we're sort of feel like we're in a privileged position where we should be trying to offer our support to universities and allowing them to do research in our stable. But it also benefits us because if we can find small insights or, you know, marginal gains, whether that is in nutrition or biomechanics or training horses, and we've actually recently started some research with University of Melbourne looking at load management and injury prevention, so that hopefully we might be able to draw some insights on our, we've been doing RPE and acute chronic workloads, and but it just gets difficult with horses because you don't get their actual feedback or the difference, you know, with track services or duration, or we're sort of just doing our best, I suppose.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. It's you may find the same as we find, that, you know, with different stimulus, you'll get responders and you'll get non-responders. And the problem with that is when you combine all the data together, then it gets washed out. So really looking at, you know, individual-based analysis, I think it's a really productive way to go, rather than necessarily, you know, combining data can be really useful because you can get, you know, the power of large data sets can really unearth stuff, but it can also cloud your analysis if you're not careful. So I think looking at individual responses is a really productive way to go about it.
I think that's key there, touching on that base, that it's individual based, which I think we've learned a lot, Kat, you'd agree there along the way, that it's individual based training and obviously measuring like for likes when we look at the likes of the recovery or action. And I remember grabbing out all the data, looking at how much would you expect a horse to shorten its action on a rain affected track based, you know, in training. And they, as a whole, they're actually they're not actually shortening or changing their action. But when you look at it individually, they might be adapting, and it's not necessarily whether or not they preference one, which you probably see a lot in the human world as well. It's just that adaptation to a different environment in a way. So
exactly. That's the point I was referring to before about the constraints-based stuff. That's exactly the application of that. And that, you know, perhaps if you wanted a horse to shorten its stride, then maybe there's a sweet spot with you know, track, you know, the wetness of the track, which is, again, individualized. So, you know, that'd be something that would be interesting to play with.
Yeah, and I was also just going to ask you, when you're talking about responders and non-responders, what were your actual metrics there? Was it strength based, or was it like from testing? Or
That's more from a, you know, a load perspective, I suppose. I'm trying to think of a really good example of that. You know, even power training, you know, that our strength guys are doing, different people respond differently to that, and so, you know, it'll be how they recover, you know, whether they've got the capacity to actually, you know, whether they're a fast twitch athlete or a slow twitch athlete, and they'll obviously respond. Some will respond with, you know, really quick responses to power training, and others you won't get much out of based on their fibre typing. So I presume you guys do biopsies and that sort of stuff as well?
We do it based off a gene test.
Right.
Okay, and then that looks at a gene that tells us if they have got a higher degree of fast twitch or slow twitch.
Yeah, well, that'd be pretty informative, obviously. That's we sort of generally know based on how they respond to our training. We don't do biopsies. That sort of has been done in the past, but we don't do that with AFL football for sure. But yeah, you have different ways of assessing that responsiveness, I suppose. But training tells you a lot.
Yeah, and I suppose from a psychological sort of area, do you find that you have to train your, like, you have to obviously look at your individual athletes and change the way you try to get them to do something or to change, or do you have any sort of, I suppose, from a player not wanting to change the way they do something, or if you've sort of picked up some, yeah, Liz?
Yeah, the psychological component. I mean, particularly if looking at it from a skill perspective, the psychological aspect of skill acquisition is a massive determinant. Firstly, do they want to change? Are they actually aware that they've got a problem or a deficit that can be addressed? And that there can be psychological barriers to that. Some athletes have problems, accepting that they're doing something that is less than functional, or can be optimized. They can take it as a personal slight, or they've been told to do things a different way in the past, and their psychological makeup doesn't predispose them to actually take information in really well. There are a whole lot of things. It may be that they've been told that they're really poor at a skill and don't think they can change. So that change mindset is really important. It's a massive part of what we do, particularly obviously as coaches rather than as scientists. We deal heavily in the psychological space. If you can't work in that space, you won't get very far with athletes, because it's all very well to have the data, but data's only evidence, and it doesn't actually change anything unless you can work through that with the athlete.
Yeah, absolutely. That's rings a lot of bells with us. I mean, we set up the operation, and I think I've discussed it with Cat a couple of times. It's good to have the feedback and monitoring there, but what are we actually doing to, and Cat's applying that in terms of the adaptations to training and actually, breaking down the mold of what usually would be done, and really, working around training programs to actually optimize, the peak, to get the peak performance out of some horses. And we had some success with one that Cat had changed this year, which was Akita Sushi. He got to the Melbourne Cup. It was, probably on the side of a lot of makeup of slow twitch fibers, and Cat was able to change his program and put some faster work into his training program, and it saw him sort of have a bit more of a turn of foot, and he was pretty effective in that, winning a nice race and then going on to the Melbourne Cup and performing really well. So it's not just about sort of being that boring monitoring mechanism and having that data, like you say. It's about actually what you do with that is key, no doubt.
Yeah, and I think we're talking about the responders and non-responders. I think one model that's really useful in that space is that idea of actually probing and seeing what an athlete does, or a horse in your case, and then sort of ramping up if you see a response, or dampening it down if you don't. And being adaptive, not necessarily thinking, as a coach in our world, not necessarily thinking you got all the answers, but being prepared to actually test something on a small time frame and actually see if you get a response and then adapt on the fly. So it's a test and learn sort of model, I think, which is really useful, and that's maybe something you guys could think about as well. And well, it sounds like you are, Kat. Sounds like that's exactly what you've done there.
Yeah, and you actually do see it in a horse, like when they're responding well to training, they sort of have a new aura about them. They bounce around, they sort of come on in their coat and they're bright-eyed, and you sort of actually saw that with Akita Sushi bit. And that's a big part of the training team and, what Kieran and Jack and the rest of the team do, and actually being able to see that in a horse and make those changes, and then the data is there just to sort of support that and often just help them confirm that that's what they're seeing and it's right. But yeah, it's interesting that you sort of see that yourself as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, from in trying to make technical changes with athletes, you get that bright eye sometimes, or you get the dull eye sometimes as well, and you know you're not getting through, And so you have to adapt and try something totally different and different way of framing things. You know, with us, you know, athletes learn differently. So some of them like visual presentation of information. Some like to hear it, auditory. Some like to be able to do things. And so finding the right way or the right mode of getting that across is challenging, but you've got to be prepared to adapt and, you know, look for that. You know, you can see whether there's a spark in the eye like you're talking about or not. And if you're not, you need to try something different.
Yeah, that's cool just to see that a line that, you know, at the end of the day, they're athletes and they're all individuals, and that's what we love about coaching or training. It's that sort of realization that you're getting somewhere and you're seeing the benefits of the changes that you've made and getting a result.
No, I was just going to say, I think that really captures, you know, how my philosophy has changed working in that space. I think when I started off in biomechanics, it was, I'm really keen to use numbers to prove and capture the ideal technique. Now the numbers are a sort of, you're on a journey and you use the numbers to give you feedback and adapt. And the athlete's learning rather than you teaching, which is a little bit different way to go about it.
Yeah, that is well put. And I would definitely agree that that's sort of the journey that we've been on here as well. I think we could probably just continue to talk and talk all day, but that's been very insightful. I've really enjoyed talking to you, Dave, and hopefully you have a successful season this year with Essendon. I know we've got a few Essendon fans in the office, so they'll be very interested to listen to the podcast. And I'm sure we can maybe have some more chats maybe outside of this podcast, because it'd be definitely interesting to discuss a few things further.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys are doing some really interesting stuff. It'd be great to hear some more of it.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for your time, Dave. Appreciate it.
No worries. Good to chat, guys. Bye.